tonight on Arena. Piper's Gay McKeown and Pádraic Keane play live in studio, and writer and director Coralie Forget on her new feature film, The Substance. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us online, rte.ie/arena. The Isan Jusuf Piping Concert, organised by Napiabri Ilan, is an annual event that showcases musicians, singers and dancers. This year's concert takes place on September the 21st at Liberty Hall Theatre in Dublin, and will feature performances from Ilan Piper's Gay McKeown and Pádraic Keane, both of whom are with me in studio this evening. Gay McKeown, CEO of Napiabri Ilan. His journey with the pipes began in the 1960s, become known for all sorts of brilliance in the meantime, including exceptional playing. Pádraic Keane, TG Cahir Young Musician of the Year back in 2011 when he was only a young pup. Now he's grown into a bigger dog, and he has performed with numerous ensembles and released his debut solo album In Full Tune a couple of years ago in 2022. As I say, both Gay and Pádraic are with me in studio this evening with their pipes, which they're holding in their laps like little children that needed to be tended and cared for. How moody are the pipes, Gay?
Oh, they're probably as moody as the players, Sean. Yeah, they are they're a complex instrument, so there's a lot of elements, and so take a lot of care and attention, and they're affected by temperature, humidity, altitude, and all sorts, you know.
And they are a temperamental instrument for sure, Pádraic. But it struck me, I was watching the thing with you on the Traditional Music Archive today, and even chatting to both of you beforehand. The instruments that both of you have here with you, they carry history within them. So maybe they're allowed to be a little bit temperamental.
Yeah, you have to kind of approach them in a different way. And there's a beauty to them as well. But a lot of the older sets, like these two ones we have here, have been restored thanks to like facilities that Napiabri Ilan have. And they've allowed people to study these older sets and learn from them. But they can be a nightmare sometimes. You know?
Yeah, the pipes that you have sitting on the desk there in front of you, what's the lineage there? Because it's as much about the players as it is about the instrument makers, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this set was it was given to me in 2017 by a man called Ken McLeod. He was from Dromore in County Down, and he passed on a number of Ilan pipes to players down through the years. But this particular set he had, and they were built in Dublin by a man called Timothy Cana. And he moved his business from Mullingar in 1812 along the banks of the Liffey there on Essex Quay. And so they were built between then and 1837. And I was just thinking there, Gay also has an older set by a man called Maurice Coyne. And Maurice Coyne was a pipe maker also in the 1800s, but he took over Timothy Cana's workshop. So a lot of the similar tools would have been used on the both sets.
But it is extraordinary for an instrument that you both have admitted can be quite temperamental, that they last that length of time, and that they carry such a tradition within them, as I said, Gay, as much about the player as it is about the instrument maker, as Pádraic was telling us about there. Tell us about your pipes.
Yeah, this set was made by Leo Rosum, who I was these were made in the 1930s. So Leo was an exceptional maker and indeed a player and teacher, but people would have heard the likes of Paddy Keane of Finbar Fury, Paddy Maloney, Liam O'Flynn play his pipes, and very, very distinctive, rich sounds. So the instruments are very organic, Sean, and if you mind them, you know, if they stay physically intact, the key is getting good reeds. And there's 7 reeds in a basic set of pipes and in a full set of pipes. So the balancing, and I think everybody's personality gets reflected in the ultimate sound, but certainly what the makers had in mind is the foundation, and then it's down to the players what they make of them.
I'll get you to make your way over to the seat. Now, what are you going to play when you get over there first?
Yeah, thanks, Sean. I'll play the March of the King of Leash, and a tune called
Gilbert
Clancy's.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, as Gay's making his way over there, Pádraic, both your cases, Gay mentioning Leo Rosum there, and family steeped in piping, your own family steeped in piping as well.
Yeah, so it was my father, Tommy Keane. He's a piper and he's from Watford. And then my mother, she's a concertina player, but her father was Tommy McCarthy, a piper from West Clare. And there was a, you know, he played concertina and whistle, but in the 1940s, he heard Leo Rousham, who taught Gay, actually, playing on the radio when he was a young lad. He used to do a 30-minute programme and every Friday for a few minutes, and he heard that and he was just intrigued.
That's
by the sound.
I
he went to Orm.
You,
he
so
went up
you
to
hear
Dublin.
That story so much, yeah, don't yeah. you? For not only the pipes, but for yeah. instruments, that somebody hears the sound and goes, that's the one I want to play. Right, Gay's sitting in position and ready to start for us with the March of the King of Leash, followed by Gilbert Clancy's. Stuff indeed. Gay McKeown there with two tunes, the March of the King of Leash, and then Gilbert Clancy's, a beautiful bright tone off those pipes indeed. You were telling me about one of your ancestors, Eureka moment with the pipes. What was your, did you have one yourself, Pádraig Keane? Pádraig Keane is also in studio with us this evening.
I suppose when I was growing up, I would have just been in the house.
You'd no choice.
It was
the instrument that was everywhere.
I wasn't locked in the shed or anything, but it was just kind of osmosis, I suppose. Yeah. And just, I got a practice set in Willie Clancy Week when I was about 8 or 9. I was down in Milltown Malby, and the club, in Nipeabri Illan, do a pipes on loan scheme. So through that, I got a lovely little practice set with a bright purple velvet bag on it, made by a man down in Kerry, Killian O'Brien. Started on that. Yeah, I remember going back to the house then and trying a few things on it. My grandfather was there. So it was nice for him to see. He actually passed away that year.
All right. So he saw that you were heading that direction.
So it was nice. But just, I suppose, it was natural. Then my dad would just guide me along the way, and we go to different events, and there might be workshops and little classes and stuff.
You know? And I guess like your own family, Gay, you grew up in a piping family, and Leo Rousham as the teacher, and the pipers that you would have heard. I was watching the two of you talking about it. Pádraig came in, was just playing something on the pipes, and you immediately could identify from the way he was playing who had taught him the tune.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about how that kind of tradition is handed on.
Yeah, well, it's probably like jazz, and that the traditional music is the basic melody and the structure there and the notes. But it's what's the, I suppose, the X factor or the special thing. Well, there's two elements. It's the instrument, as we spoke about, but also the interpretation of the individual player. And I suppose we're so nerdy, or we get so, accustomed to listen to one another that we quickly we have a good idea, or a very good educated guess at you know, the source. And it's that we try to, in the PBL, and we try to mentor young players, and it's brilliant to see wonderful gifted players like Pádraig coming through, and we try and share old recordings, legacy recordings and archival material, and it's kind of like an osmosis, and they take bits, we all take bits and pieces of stuff we hear and we add to it, and that's what makes it interesting.
In fact, I was telling you earlier, Pádraig, a programme, or it's an online thing that you did, Drawing from the Well, with the Traditional Music Archive, and you were talking there about Michael Carney, wasn't it, a piper who went off to America but seemed to have huge influence in terms of the instrument itself and the instrument that he played, and also the way he played them.
Yeah, like he emigrated out there in the 1890s, early 1890s, but he had a bad accident in around 1910 in New York. He was working with machines, and he ended up losing the use of his legs. So he can manage legs. He ended up in a wheelchair. So he kind of threw himself completely into pipe making and piping. And he was going around New York doing concerts and stuff, and there was a lot of benefit concerts for him, but he provided, he was a reed maker as well, he was a fantastic reed maker, which is essential in playing the pipes, as Gay mentioned. So he provided all the musicians in New York, which there were a lot at that time, were the pipers with great reeds, including Patsy Toohey was one of them.
Yeah, and you told a lovely story on that, and which I think Gay echoed about another piper. But on the night that Michael Carney was dying, what he did in terms of a tune that he wanted to pass on.
Yeah, they were over at his house. He lived in Brooklyn, and it was a kind of halfway house where a lot of musicians would call in, and there was two pipers there, and they were kind of debating over a phrase of a tune called The Morning Star, which is a great piping tune, very popular at that time. He wanted to show them something, so they turned the chanter around for him. So he played the melody, and the lads blew the bellows and bag, and he just turned and showed them. He could do all this really intricate stuff on the pipes, little triplets and stuff. So it was something in relation to that kind of thing on the melody.
So it was literally he wanted it handed on in the right way.
Yeah, he
now,
shared
you're going to make your way over to. What are you going to play just before you go, Pádraig? What are you going to play for us?
Well, seeing as the Ace and Juice is coming up, I might do a version of the Ace and Juice piping. It's one that's kind of connected with West Clare.
Yeah, isn't it a set?
It's a set dance. Yeah. So it's kind of known as a great piping piece, but also it was known in West Clare in the late 1800s by a man called Garrett Barry, who was a blind piper, and he used to play it, and it was kind of an example of the that they play for a dancer, a solo dancer. So,
You can make it, and as you're doing that, we might expect people saying, why didn't they get the two of them to play together? That would have been an awful disaster, really.
We're in different pitches.
Not because you're enemies, but explain that thing about, because Peter, our Pádraig's pipes are referred to as being flat pipes. What does that mean?
Yeah, generally, the set I play there is in concert pitch, so we can play along with an orchestra or whatever. But there's sets, only came about in the early 1900s when pipers emigrated to America, so they needed louder instruments to play in dance halls. But prior to that, all pipes were flat pitched, so either C sharp, C, B, B flat, and that was the norm.
Yeah.
But like every maker just made the instrument, and they usually they are well in tune in their for the pitch.
Yeah,
but sometimes it can be halfway between. I think Pádraig said that he's going to play now at Cana is somewhere below C and above B.
So it's kind of in between two notes. But they can play, in other words, they're instruments that have to be played by themselves because they won't be in tune.
Pretty much are. If a fiddle player tuned, or a stringed instrument could be tuned.
And I think the bat-eared will notice. Yours had that bright. Yours are in a higher pitch.
Yeah.
A C or a D, was it?
It's D.
D, yeah.
Concert pitch. So there's a very vibrant, bright.
Very bright. Whereas when we hear these, and I was really struck by it earlier on, Pádraig, it's a much more mellow sound.
Yeah,
so
very
flat,
mellow.
Flat is not necessarily a derogatory term in this case.
No, not at all.
Well, here we are then, since we are talking about the Ace and Juice of Piping Concert. Let's have a movement from that set of dances. ¶¶ Beautiful stuff. Beautiful stuff indeed there with the that air from the Ace and Jupe set, Ace and Juice set dance. And the Ace and Jupe piping concert, or Ace and Juice of Piping concert, takes place on Saturday the 21st of September at 8 p.m. Several pipers there. Sean Galvin will be there. Emer Mayock will be there with the Ilan Pipes, and Pádraig Keane, who you've just been hearing. Other instruments represented. The Hurleys will be there with Mairead and Deirdre with concertina and flute. Connie O'Connell on fiddle. Aoin O'Connor on fiddle. Francis O'Connor on flute. And other. Rosie Stewart will be singing a few songs along the way. And Dairn Glacken will be keeping everybody in order on the night. She'll be emceeing. Pádraig agus Gurnamila Mahangat Berth as Chalk to Chalk Ling and Nook. That was absolutely gorgeous. Thanks very much. This year's Cannes Film Festival audience was shocked by the body horror film The Substance, starring Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley. But the film also received one of the festival's longest standing ovations. The Substance is directed by Coralie Forget, whose debut feature was the award-winning The Revenge. The Substance tells the story of Elizabeth Sparkle, played by Demi Moore, former film star and now an ageing TV Keep Fit star instructor, who is dropped by her bosses because they want to replace her with a younger woman. Elizabeth finds it impossible to cope with this rejection and takes desperate measures when she hears about the elixir of youth called The Substance.
Have you ever dreamt of a better version of yourself? Younger, more beautiful, more perfect. One single injection unlocks your DNA, starting a new cellular division that will release another version of yourself. This is The Substance.
Elizabeth Sparkle buys into The Substance, which involves a painful body transformation that results in the creation of a clone. But can the aging self in the form of Demi Moore and her youthful clone, played by Margaret Qualley, live in harmony? Well, take a look at Oscar Wilde. Did the picture of Dorian Gray stay pristine in the attic while Dorian sowed his wild wicked oats? In other words, The Substance is a recipe for a body horror fest. Kay Sheehy spoke to the film's director.
You're very welcome, Honorina Curley. The Substance is a film about women's bodies and the societal pressures women are under to have the perfect body. You call this pressure a jail society has built. Can you explain what you mean and what led you to making The Substance?
Basically, like, I think as women from our very young ages, we are kind of, you know, conditions to meet certain expectations about how we should look like, you know, to be perfect or to be considered as a good woman, or, you know, or a sexy woman, or, you know, everything that's make you going to be valued into society and give you a feeling that you have a place in society. And as soon as you step out of those boxes, it's almost as if, you know, we don't want to see you, we don't want to hear you. And it's this is the violence that I wanted to express with the Substance. And because also those injunctions, like, we kind of internalize them from a very young age, and like, we put this pressure upon ourselves in a very internal way, which makes it kind of hard to escape from, which why I'm talking about the jail.
Yes, I don't know whether you can put an age on it, but sometimes it's thought that women over 40 should not be seen. And it is very, you know, do you think that society is still like that? It's still so defining of women by how they look?
Oh, yes, like, totally. You know, how they look, what their age is, what their curves are, you know, like, whether she can still have children or not. Like, all this is such a strong lens through which we are still viewed. And unfortunately, kind of changes slightly, but the majority of it, to me, unfortunately, is still very much, you know, built around those kind of strong, like male gaze injunctions that we've been living through for more than 2,000 years now.
So what can you tell us about Elizabeth Sparkle, the character played by Demi Moore, who's very much heading into that jail you spoke about?
Yeah, so that character to me was the idea of representing, you know, the highest representation of what we can go through as women, like basically putting my character as being an actress who puts herself under the spotlight is like because she's seeking love from external eyes. Her way of existing, her way of, you know, getting love is through the lens of people watching at her. It's like having, you know, the spotlight on her. It's like having people giving her attention by looking at her. And when, you know, she doesn't have that anymore, when the spotlights turn off, when, you know, people start to look to whoever come next, like it feels her world totally collapse because like it was her way of getting loved, of getting recognition, of getting, you know, a place in the world. So when this goes away, it's like her whole life, which collapsed. And to me, that was a very strong, symbolical way to incarnate the way we can feel that our whole life is destroyed when we feel that we don't meet the right expectations, when we don't meet, you know, the right appearance, when we pass the age that we feel that, you know, that's what society values us for. So that was a very, for me, symbolical way to express this through what Elizabeth Sparkle is going to experience in her fiction life.
Yes, Elizabeth Sparkle was a very famous movie star, and then she had a subsequent career as a keep fit guru with her own television program. But of course, that's pulled when they think they should get a younger model. So what can you, I know you don't want to tell us too much about The Substance, but what can you tell us about what The Substance is and the appearance of the character Sue, played by Margaret Qualley?
Well, The Substance is kind of promising you to change your life. Like, you know, it's really seen as the magic product that can make all your dream come true. And the dream in, you know, getting to giving you another version of yourself, that it's you, but just better. Like, you know, which is younger, which is more beautiful, which is more perfect, which has everything that you think you don't have. So it's kind of the dream that's going to transform into a nightmare because like this idealized version of yourself kind of, you know, stays within the same trap of wanting external validation from, you know, external eyes. So the other you is kind of, you know, getting you at first what you think is going to solve all your problems, but the problem is still very much within you. So it's going to turn out that the problems are still there.
Now, for Irish viewers, the similarities with Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray won't be lost. It's a very strong influence, this idea that there's the portrait in the attic taking on all the ugliness of your sins while you remain eternally young. There are similarities or echoes of it in The Substance.
Yes, it's a... to me, it's such a powerful story. And definitely the portrait of Dorian Gray kind of address in its own form what is a very, you know, mythological, philosophical and eternal, you know, quest, human quest from wanting to escape our own mortality. You know, I think one of the biggest dreams of human being has been to escape from his mortal condition, which also translates into aging, stopping aging, eternal youth. So to me, those are super strong topics because they are kind of relate to everyone, everywhere. And the Dorian Gray was a beautiful incarnation of, you know, shaping those stories, such as the Faustian pact, you know, and I love the fact I love and I'm sad, but I think it's very true that this quest is still very much true nowadays. And I think The Substance is my very own modern take on the subject, you know, of topic and theme that have been unfortunately true since the beginning of humanity.
Indeed. And why then did you choose body horror as the genre to represent this wonderful image which nods to the portrait of Dorian Gray?
Yeah, I think body horror was to me a way to incarnate what I was really feeling into my flesh, you know, the violence of all this. And the portrait of Dorian Gray, you know, is kind of frozen onto an image. And I felt I wanted the image to be alive and to show what's inside, you know, behind the pearly smiles, the violence of everything that happens underneath. And to me, body horror is such a powerful, visceral genre that really makes you feel all the violence that all these quests, you know, can be, and the kind of constant tyranny that it can, you know, inflict on yourself. And I loved, to me, the idea that I can show it for real on camera, in the metamorphosis, in the transformation, in the way the body is going to, as you say, as a portrait, the body is going to take all the deformation and everything we want to hide and get rid of. It's going to crystallize on the body and all the transformations that Elizabeth is going to endure during the film.
Well, it definitely does. Coralie Farget, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you so much.
In 1992, Iranian pop star and refugee Feridun Farrokh Hassad was found brutally murdered in Germany. The case was never solved. That story is part of Things Hidden Since the Foundation of the World, a work by Javed Alipour with Chris Thorpe that explores violence, digital culture and the post-colonial world. It's described as an investigation into both an iconic murder and an investigation into the nature of investigation itself. The show tells its stories in different ways, including murder mystery podcast methods, music and informal storytelling. Delighted to be joined on the line by the writer and director of Things Hidden Since the Foundation of the World, Javed Alipour. Nice to have you on the programme with us, Javed. Just for those who may not be aware of this great Iranian pop star who was absolutely huge in his day, Feridun Farrokhzad, tell us a little bit about him and what was the attraction of telling his story as part of your show?
Well, thanks for having me. Feridun Farrokhzad was, I sometimes refer to him as a bit like Iran's Tom Jones, if you like. So that level of kind of pop cultural icon. But if Tom Jones was also a TV producer and a political dissident and, you know, someone who sort of shifted musical culture
Sorry, you just dropped out there briefly. Did you want to finish that out? The line just dropped briefly.
I have Iranian heritage on my father's side, and he really was someone who shifted how Iran thought about itself at that time. And look, ultimately, I think that what's interesting about his story is that the story of Farrokhzad's murder is not something that happened in the past. It's something that really begins a new world. You know, if you go back to the 60s, 70s and 80s, countries like England, perhaps, Germany, America, Ireland, different countries in the West felt like safe places for dissidents from, Iran or Russia or China. But actually, Farrokhzad's murder begins a chapter of a kind of increased globalization of political repression that we see, you know, more and more intensely now, right? So I'm sure you saw the stories, like, over the past couple of years. I could tell you about Iranian journalists that have been, stabbed in London, Chinese dissidents beaten up outside the consulate in Manchester and so on. So for me, it's the intersection of those two things. It's what's really interesting about the Middle East at that time and what's interesting about the West now.
And you mentioned there, yes, he was this global pop star, and I was looking at an image of him online today, and he has the great moustache, the black hair, yeah, the dress suit, all of those Tom Jones type of, well, Tom Jones doesn't have a moustache, but all of those great Tom Jones type of looks, and the voice, absolutely beautiful. But behind all of that, you mentioned there, the political dissidents and a television producer, and obviously at a time in Iran when it wasn't a good thing to be saying what you thought about the authorities. He was murdered in Germany at a time when he was working in a greengrocer's, and I think living above the greengrocer's shop, practically unknown.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he went from being someone who could, and this is a super interesting part of his story, really. Like, he went from being a man who couldn't walk down the street without being mobbed to, you know, another Iranian refugee in Germany, you know, working part-time in a greengrocer's to support himself and living in an apartment above it. But at the same time, just before he was murdered, a commercial Iranian producer hired the Royal Albert Hall, and he sold it out for like two nights. Iranians flew in from all over the world to see him perform because, you know, it's the first time that Tom Jones had been on had been on stage in sort of 10 or 12 years. And I think there's something really interesting there about, again, about globalization, right? The fact that it's possible for us to, you know, in the great cities of the world now, you know, in many ways, there are dozens of other worlds, dozens of other modernities that are rubbing shoulders against each other. And part of what this show is about asking the question that says, you know, morally, politically, what is our responsibility to other people in that world?
And his story, and the second story that I want you to tell us a little bit about, if you would too, Javad, is the story of Ram Emami and his father. His father also died in suspicious circumstances.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like you say, at the heart of this show is really a sort of psychedelic send-up of murder mystery podcasting. And we sort of do that to, you know, we use that to explore the story of Fereyd and Fahd Rokhzad, but we do want to explore that the even more contemporary resonances of that. So Ram is a contemporary Iranian rock star and podcaster, huge in Iran before he had to escape. And his father was quite a famous environmental campaigner. He was campaigning against the degradation of the ecology that supports, there was some of the most impressive wildlife in Iran, so like the Asiatic cheetahs and Caspian leopards and so on. Now, the problem with campaigning against ecological degradation in Iran is it brings you up against the corruption at the heart of the regime, right? And Ram's father was accused of spying for the West, disappeared from his house and taken to jail, from which he was never seen alive again. Ram and his family had to escape the country, and he lives in Canada and between Canada and the US as a kind of refugee, and has these really interesting parallels with Fahd Rokhzad's story there, you know, in terms of like, he's come from something and he's in something else in the West. He's also a really beautiful musician and makes incredible music. There's a lot of music in this show. You know, it's very difficult for me to direct a play about two musicians without there being a load of music in it. And so we have a lot of fun sound of Iran, right? From the 70s, where it sounds a bit disco-y, to like now, where there's really great alternative rock and new wave.
Yeah, and Ram, as you say, a musician in his own right. So you have, he tells the story of his father and his own story in the process, and he uses a lot of music and straightforward informal storytelling to do that. But you also have this on stage, possibly slightly off stage, live podcast happening into our ears as well, in that murder mystery style of podcasting that has become so popular in recent times. Why did you want to use that podcasting style? And I think you're not exactly praising it to high heaven, it must be said.
No, I mean, you know, I think it's just a really interesting cultural phenomenon. This show is come out of a series of shows that I've been making, where I've been thinking about the intersection between international politics and how the world feels like it's changing at a pace that we can't quite keep up with. But the intersection between that and everyday usage of digital technology. can I say? I'm something like a frustrated anthropologist, or perhaps even a recovering Marxist. So I sort of think that the everyday things we do shape our mind and our souls, if you know what I mean. And I think that there's the connectivity that the internet gives us, the ability to look up things on Wikipedia, deep dive into cold cases on Murder Mystery Podcast, is a sort of a double-edged sword, really. On the one hand, it can sort of democratize and connect us to ideas all around the world, but it also channels and channels us into a certain thing and shapes, I suppose, what questions are possible to ask and what questions feel impossible. So there's a bit of love to the way that we're sending up that podcast world, you know, but we are a little bit mean in places as well, I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah, and a bit funny about it all in places, it has to be said too.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah. I mean, clearly the two deaths that we're speaking about, there's no laughing matter in either of those stories. But you have a lot of fun here at a time when you also are on stage as a kind of a, almost like a lecturer to us in terms of political ideas and socio-political ideas, quite complex ideas that contextualise both these stories. That it really is, I think it's referred to at some point in your publicity as a boisterous mashup of forms. You are putting three or four different ways of telling stories together.
Yeah, I mean, we are. And I think I really... things that I think is super just obvious about the world as we engage with it now is it is a series of mashed up forms and stories, right? Like if you're watching a film at home on Netflix, often you've got your double screening, you're looking up on Wikipedia who the what else the actor's been in, you know, at the same time you're processing it by talking about it on Twitter. And so I think there's, if you're trying to tell a story that feels about the world now, by its nature, it's not going to be in sort of a traditional form. So it is quite a psychedelic experience, I think people say, when they've seen it.
And how it has all of those aspects to it, but how close is it to a traditional theatre experience?
Well, you know, there are some jokes. It's a very visual experience. I think if people, you know there's a sort of genre of kind of contemporary work, you know, where we're asking people to come into the theatre with relatively few assumptions. So it probably sits in that sort of tradition of theatre, but it is where it's more sort of traditional, I think, is actually because there's a lot going on, because there's a lot of visual stuff to take in, you know, I like to think there's a real sense of theatricality and showmanship to it, but I'll let, you know, that's for the audience to decide.
You also, you have your company, your own company, the Javed Alipour Company, is unashamedly political in everything you do. You have a nine-point manifesto where politics is at the very heart of what you do. Where is the balance for you between that kind of political expression, something close to activism, and political artistry, which is, you know, the job of the artist? How do you manage, how do you marry your activism and your artistry?
Well, I mean, thank you. I mean, it's a really, really great question. I mean, there is a part of me that is more of an activist. That part of me is sure of what he thinks should do, is sure of a policy prescription, would like the world to be a certain specific way. The part of me that an artist is more concerned with the things that I don't have an answer to, like questions that sort of haunt me that I would like to find a way to share with an audience. I think the job of an artist is in terms of politics. I mean, I see a lot of political theatre, films, arts, and often it strikes me that actually artistically it's not that interesting and the politics ain't that deep. And I think the way out of that is to engage with art as something which is not just intellectual, which sticks to your heart and guts as well. Yeah. And most fundamentally as something which is about form and artifice and slyness and irony, not about, you know, a kind of work that I find quite frustrating, which is about, kind of an emotive attempt to make agitprop, if you like.
Yeah, because, and it should be said, it's a nine-point manifesto, the ninth point of which is things have to be fun. Yeah. The other eight are quite political. The ninth one is quite definitely in the fun area. Javed, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
That's Javed Alipour, who, along with Chris Thorpe, has written Things Hidden Since the Foundation of the State of the World. Beg your pardon. It runs at the Samuel Beckett Theatre from the 10th through until the 12th of October. Javed and members of the company will be talking theatre after the show on Thursday the 10th. Full information on that and everything happening at the festival on DublinTheatreFestival.ie. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Paula Shields researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Pat Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. And John Creedon is back in the seat in Cork after the news.